Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday morning, July 12th. 63 degrees here in Old Town Park City and smoky. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cesar Cornejo. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. We continue to see all of that smoke still hanging around. It has not left us from this past weekend. We're expecting to see that temperatures also will be still on the warm side. We're expecting to see a high of 92 degrees, even though we don't see much of the sun. It is out there. We still have the possibility of some sunburns, so please make sure to use some sunscreen if you're going outdoors today. And tonight, we continue to see the patchy smoke, partly cloudy skies, and then by Tuesday, we start to see the return of some monsoonal moisture making its way in. That gives us the chance of some showers for the afternoon time frame. We expect to still see the smoky skies, but as that rain moves in, starts to help clear us out a bit, brings in some newer, fresher air, we can expect to see some clearing finally. Tuesday night, we remain a little bit on the patchy side for smoke, but that starts to subside. Wednesday, we start off the morning dry, but we continue to end up seeing some more shower activity going around for us. We'll see mostly sunny skies, a high near 86 degrees again, and some breezy conditions for us, but not too much of an issue. The showers continue for parts of Wednesday night, as we still see most of them hanging around the higher terrain. We'll see a low of around 59, and by Thursday, we still have a slight chance of shower activity for the afternoon hours. That is also accompanied by a high of 85 degrees with mostly sunny skies. Thursday, we start to lose that moisture and we start to calm down, seeing a low of 61 with partly cloudy skies. Friday, we continue once again, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly in the afternoon and evening time frame, mostly sunny skies, a high of 86 once again, mostly clear skies. So we start to finally dry out a bit more for parts of Friday night. And we continue with a low of 60 for Sunday. Saturday will be a sunny day, no longer seeing any chances of rain. So a great time to go out for a weekend adventure, a high of 87. So it will be a little bit on the warm side. And we'll see mostly clear skies with a low around 62 on Saturday night. Sunday, we start to get close to the 90s once again as high pressure still builds in for us and sunny conditions for us also. And we continue to be just marvelous for the weekend. From the Pinpoint Weather Center, I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cesar Cornejo.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with the executive director of the National Ski Hall of Fame, Justin Koski, with details about three of this year's inductees, all from the Park City area: Holly Flanders, Hank Tauber, and Howard Peterson. Then University of Utah professor Daniel Mendoza with details on a new published study detailing how our air quality changed in Park City during the COVID-19 pandemic, with one of those air quality sensors right here on the KPCW rooftop. Then Park City Education Foundation Executive Director Abby McNulty with an update on some of the programs being offered by the foundation. Well, friends and family held a memorial service Friday for a Park City man who was killed in a motorized skateboarding accident over the 4th of July weekend. The tragic death highlights the importance of helmets, no matter how casual you think your trip might be. Sean Higgins has more.
According to the Summit County Sheriff, 46-year-old Will Lundberg was found unresponsive on the bike path near the Highland Drive trailhead at Round Valley on Friday, July 2nd. Lundberg crashed while riding a motorized skateboard. He was not wearing a helmet and passed away the next day after being transported to a Salt Lake area hospital with a significant head injury. A vigil was held in Park City for Lundberg on Monday, and memorial services at the Church of Dirt took place Friday. A GoFundMe page has also been set up for his wife and two young children. In an obituary, the Lundberg family extended their sincere thanks to emergency and medical staff involved for their efforts. Dr. Scott McIntosh is an emergency physician at the University of Utah and the medical director of Summit County EMS, which includes the Park City Fire District. He told KPCW the ER has seen a rise in head injuries in recent years as electric-powered bikes and skateboards have become more popular. He said it's important to wear a helmet, no matter how old you are or how short your trip may be.
Wearing a helmet at all times is just so crucial to overall safety, whether you're young or whether you're old. As we get older, our brain atrophies, and it makes it more susceptible actually to even minor trauma than young folks' brains. But wearing a helmet at all ages, when you're doing an activity that you can have even just a fall from a short height, is really, really important.
The Park City Hospital is equipped to treat some traumatic injuries, but the most serious are transferred to what are called Level 1 trauma centers. There are only three Level 1 centers in the state: the University of Utah Hospital, Primary Children's Hospital, and the Intermountain Medical Center. All three are in the Salt Lake Valley and require a lengthy ambulance ride or helicopter evacuation if a serious accident occurs in the Wasatch Back. McIntosh said certain trauma specialists are only found at Level 1 centers.
The neurosurgeons, the orthopedic doctors that handle really complex bone injuries, the vascular surgeons that can repair arteries and bleeding arteries, those things are really at just high level and specialized trauma centers.
There are no laws in Utah that require helmets when riding a bike or other non-motorized vehicles. Even on motorcycles and electric bikes, helmets are not required unless the driver or passenger is under the age of 21. Helmets are also a good idea when participating in activities like rock climbing or mountaineering to protect against falling rock or equipment. Despite the protection helmets do provide, McIntosh added that it is still possible to sustain a head injury even if you are wearing one.
You know, you can still get brain bleeds even if you're wearing helmets. You can get concussions, and so it's, you know, you just need to be cautious in the first place, and helmets are one of the things that can help you either survive an injury or help make the damage a little bit less if you do have an accident.
A link to the Lundberg Family Fundraiser can be found on our website, kpcw.org. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, three of this year's U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame inductees are from the Park City area. On the phone with details, I have the executive director of the Ski Hall of Fame based in Nishpeming, Michigan, Justin Koski. Good morning, Justin.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing great, though. Thanks. So the three inductees, Olympian Holly Flanders, longtime FIS board member and coach of the U.S. ski team, Hank Tauber, and an influential leader with the U.S. Ski and Association, and one of those helping to bring the Winter Olympic Games to Utah, Howard Peterson, who's just passed away in the last year. So talk to us a little bit, how were they nominated?
Yeah, Leslie, love to talk about that, and great, thanks for having me. Our process actually is currently underway. We're right in the thick of the election for the class of 2021, so even though we've not been able to walk people across the stage because of the holdup with the pandemic and live events, but we have continued this process. So it's a really intricate and well-put-together process that we've been using for many decades, you know, starting with, receiving nominations. A really important thing to know about the Hall of Fame is anybody can nominate anybody, but that nomination has to start, and it is a good deal, a chunk of work to put a good rock solid nomination together for a viable candidate for the Hall. The rules and guidelines are all available also on our website at Ski Hall. But once somebody's nominated, Leslie, they end up getting in front of the selection committee, their packet does, and there's a committee that considers all nominations and votes to build a ballot every year. That ballot is created around this time of the year through vying, you know, looking at every viable candidate and placing athletes and non-athletes on the ballot. That's important. Two of the three people you mentioned that we're talking about today are coming in through that non-athlete category with Howard and Hank. Then from there, we have a national voting panel that votes the first 2 weeks of August every year. That voting panel is made up of over 400 individuals, all influential, you know, ski industry people from different boards and organizations that are partnered with the Hall of Fame. And that's where the actual selecting of the top candidates happens each year off of the ballot. And, you know, usually three or four athletes are selected depending on the cycle, and a few non-athletes to round off each class.
Okay, so these at this point, these three are considered nominees.
Yeah, we kind of created a new term for them, actually, Leslie. They're honoree elects right now. They've been successful in being chosen through that process I just laid out. They just haven't been formally elected yet, and we just felt like they deserved to the time on stage, and everybody's been super patient. All the elect honoree-elects have been very patient in waiting for their time to be honored live on the big stage with their friends and fans and colleagues. So Hank, Howard, and, or Howard's family receiving on his behalf, and Holly are all going to be inducted this coming spring, the end of this coming ski season.
Okay. How many nominations do you get every year?
We're constantly managing between 60 and 70 nominations, Leslie. Usually 7 to 10 per year come in. And then, of course, 7 are successful. So that number kind of hovers around 70 very qualified people.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, there are different categories for the candidates, athletes, snow sport builders, and heritage athletes. I get. What about the other two?
Yeah, the sport builder and heritage categories are your typical, industry powerhouses, I call them. A good example, being in Park City would be an Edgar Stern, on the resort side of things. Hank, another great one. Hank, you mentioned, earlier, he wore several hats within the industry with his time at Marker, on the binding side, Fist, ski team ambassador, U.S. ambassador. Those types of people are going to be your builders, and heritage. Now, you can nominate somebody and select heritage as their category, but the selection committee considers all those people as builders first, and then they choose a few heritage candidates each year to put on the ballot.
Okay, so that's done by then the selection committee in terms of whether it's heritage or not.
Correct. Yeah, and the heritage category does have a few requirements, like the person has to be long retired or had more than 25 years within the role that they're being nominated to the Hall of Fame for. But you get a lot of different people, Leslie. You get the innovators, inventors. People like Denny Hansen, people that are, on the equipment side, the resort side, Ski Patrol, PSIA, a lot of really good qualified people that are nominated each year within those couple categories to consider.
Okay, so would they be considered kind of the class of 2021, 2020? Because I know that you didn't get to do anything last year, so you still need to honor the 2019 inductees as well.
Right. And the three Park City folks that we're talking about here, they are all part of the class of 2020. The class of 2019 is still also prior to them waiting, because they were supposed to be honored in Sun Valley on March 26th of 2020. We obviously canceled that event officially on the 12th of March, right before everything shut down and quarantine happened and the ski resorts all fell like dominoes. So they're waiting also. That class, I don't have it, all in front of me. It's been a busy morning, but the class of 2019 was, Kit Delorier we had in that class. We had seven or eight different people slated for Sun Valley they're just going to wait for 2 years and be inducted this coming March again in Sun Valley.
Okay, and so that's what you're going to do. You're going to be hosting two induction galas this spring, one in Sun Valley, I guess, for the 2019 folks, and then one in New Hampshire for the 2020 folks?
Close, very close with what you said. A mix of both classes have been chosen for those two venues. And you and I didn't discuss this prior to the call, but I'll tell you, like Holly Flanders, for example, originally from Sunapee, New Hampshire, her hometown. Lots of friends, family, and folks out east. Same with Howard Peterson and his wife's ashes, I believe, are both spread at Bretton Woods, where the event's going to be. He originally started his early ski career out east before going on to do, very powerful things with the ski team out in Utah. And, same with Hank Tauber. He's from Gloversville, I believe, New York, originally. And there's just a lot of East ties. Within my position at the ski hall, it's very cool to see how, you take somebody, that's primarily known in the West or in the mountain region and go East, and there's still hundreds of of really close people that show up. So we kind of divvied up the class of 19 and 20 between those two based on looking at the dynamics of where their hometowns were, where they're from, where most of their friends and family are, et cetera, to try to accommodate it. And we're going to have to do that same thing with this class we're electing right now at the end of this year and next year to get caught up. So we will be hosting two separate induction ceremonies for 2 years in a row to get caught up for missing 2 years, and then likely be back to how we used to do it, Leslie, like when we were in Salt Lake in 2019, doing a single event and having everybody come to one.
Okay. Well, I've been to the International Ski Hall of Fame, and it's not that big, and you're quickly running out of room. So what's the future for that, given that you're adding 7 to 10 inductees a year?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you asked that. We're working with a bunch of people, a little effort that's going on right now, for example, with looking at space in the COE right there in town, and having our good friend Tom Kelly work with us and work with the team over there to find space to do little satellite museums there, and we have a couple other locations in mind. We're also looking at a traveling display that we can bring with us when we go, you know, Birds of Prey or Killington or any of the other places, even OR and the different shows that we go to each year. We do have a good chunk of space in Ishpeming. The problem is most people can't even say Ishpeming, let alone point to it on a map or figure out what airport to fly into to get to it.
And I think people would say, well, why the heck Ishpeming then? Tell us why it's there.
Right, yeah, it's great. So the birthplace of the team, actually, in organized skiing. A lot of people don't realize, but in 1904, the National Ski Association was created in Ishpeming. And the ski team, the National Ski Association became and changed their name to the U.S. Ski Team in 1953, I believe, or 54, and moved out your way. But they still raise money using a 501c that was started right there in Ishpeming, and that's why they dedicated the museum and also gave us the green light on becoming the Hall of Fame in 1956 and housing all the legends of our sport right there in Ishpeming at the museum.
Okay, and just in the few minutes we have left, maybe you can just give us maybe some of the highlights then of our inductees or our whatever your honorees elect. What can you say about Holly?
Well, obviously legendary female ski racing persona. She had a lot of great accolades. When you look in the athlete category, there's certain criteria that they have to fulfill with World Cup championships, Olympic medals, different things like that. Holly was an inspiration at the right time, runs in the family with her, with Eric Slopey and a lot of the other people that have been amazing racers. Howard Peterson is, you know, obviously one of those people that it's really hard to even pick what he did that was most influential, because there were so many different things that he had his hat in the ring for and pushed, you know, with the ski team, with the Olympics there in Utah. Really interesting. Same with Hank Tauber. A lot of people, in your area might know Hank, but outside of the area, one of the biggest things that we have to focus on with being the national team is the national and international impact that people had. Very often we get questions that simply just don't qualify because they're regional in their nature. You know, it might be somebody who, you know, was a phenomenal, proponent for, say, the state of Utah, in your case, but really just didn't quite have the bandwidth or go beyond that regional, you know, area. Where Hank, I mean, he was a global character for us. He was a global, and still is, spokesperson, person that you go to when you're trying to create change, whether it has to do with the safety aspects of the sport, the way that we're training our athletes, the way that we're, you know, staying competitive and staying on the podium, really. It's done behind the scenes, and Hank's been right there in the face of that his whole career. Plus, he did the marker binding thing and all his stuff with being a catalyst for some much needed change on the equipment side. So you can sit and talk about these people all day. The greatest part of what we do is getting to see all these interwoven people. The one thing that always amazes me, Leslie, is every single year how small and tight-knit and really homegrown the ski and snowboard industry is. Kind of an everybody-knows-everybody type thing, especially, at that Hall of Fame level with these sorts of people.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your time, Justin. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Leslie. Always good talking to you.
Justin Koski, again, is the executive director of the Ski Hall of Fame based in Ishpeming, Michigan. Again, we've got three honorary electors, Holly Flanders, Hank Tauber, and posthumously Howard Peterson. Along with rising temperatures and drought, climate change has another effect on the Wasatch Back, dust, and the poor air quality that comes with it. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
The scope of Utah's drought has been widely reported. Nearly all of the state is experiencing severe drought, and many of the state's bodies of water are at record low levels. In fact, the Great Salt Lake is currently the lowest since water levels have been recorded, said the Utah Rivers Council's Zach Frankel.
The last time it was this low, I believe, was 1963. So this is the first in modern history.
Frankel told KPCW when most people think of climate change, they think of summer heat waves and water shortages. He said the warming temperatures currently seen in Utah actually have a greater effect in the winter. A short winter means less snow, less runoff, and lower water levels in the summer months.
There's just a cascade of impacts that come from these increased air temperatures. Winter is shorter as a season, and as a function of that, our snowpacks are much smaller than they used to be. And that is why the Great Salt Lake is really at its lowest level in recorded history, and it sets some disturbing potential trends for the future.
One of those potential trends, he said, is poor air quality from swirling dust at dried-up lakes and reservoirs. He said those effects are already being seen in the Salt Lake Valley.
It's not just that its elevation is smaller, it's that the amount of lake is disappearing, and as that happens, we expose lake bed dust. It's creating major problems during high wind days. You can see in the Wasatch Front valleys during these high wind days, you can see these dust events where it's just really thick, poor air quality because of this lake bed dust.
With reservoirs in the Wasatch Back significantly lower than in years past, Rockport Reservoir only collected 3% of its usual snowmelt this year. Lake bed dust could become an issue in Summit and Wasatch counties, too. The solution, said Frankel, is smart water use by individuals and climate and conservation policies put in place by lawmakers. Park City recently reported the city used over 1 million fewer gallons of water over the 4th of July holiday compared to past years. Local officials have told KPCW they are focused on managing water levels so enough is available for fire crews and for reserves to last until the fall. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
One of the silver linings of the COVID pandemic was watching a man ride up and down Park City's Main Street on his horse. As people stayed indoors, their cars were garaged, that there was no traffic, and as a result, our air was cleaner too. But just how clean? On the phone, I have University of Utah Research Assistant Professor in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences, Daniel Mendoza, who monitored the air sensors during lockdown. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Yeah, so if you would, just start by giving us a little bit of background to the study. It was, I believe, help paid for by Park City's Sustainability Department?
Yes, we're very grateful for the support to Park City Sustainability Department. Originally, the idea behind the study was to look at the impact of different events on Park City's air qualities, because this idea for the study actually came by in 2019. So we actually installed the sensors late November and early December of 2019 before the COVID pandemic struck the US. So really what we wanted to look at was, for example, events such as Sundance and some of the wintertime resort air quality implications.
All right. So the fact that the sensors were already in place, you had kind of a totally different study planned.
Absolutely. And that's what we, in science call when we have this very sort of lucky event, we call it a natural experiment. I mean, we can't obviously control something like a pandemic happening, but when it does happen, we have instruments in place. This is where we can find some really interesting science. So what we did was we kept the sensors through, and they're still operating right now. One is actually located right on your rooftop of your building, the KPCW building, and then the other one is located near the mark. And so what we did was we wanted to really look at two specific sites of the city. The one on the rooftop was by Main Street was really to look at the commercial site, whereas the one at by the Mark was to really take a look at what happens in terms of emissions at the residential side. What we found were some really interesting patterns. At first, when COVID-19 was not declared an emergency here in the U.S., so really the first half of the experiment, the first couple of months of the experiment, we saw the usual patterns. So for example, when Sundance came to town, we saw a rise in PM 2.5. So what we measured was just fine particulate matter, PM 2.5, during the winter time, really, that first quarter, let's call it, up until March. And then we saw that dramatic drop when there was that effective lockdown.
Okay. So that's when the levels started to change? At the end of March?
Yes. So we, as I mentioned, we started in December, and we saw some interesting spikes during the holiday season, during the Sundance event. But then all of a sudden, we just saw a very quiet event happen after the lockdown. And what we found that was really interesting was that emissions gradually started to shift. So before, Main Street was much more lively, as you can probably remember. Businesses were going on, the activity, there was really no difference until the lockdown happened. And then little by little, we saw pollution sort of start to creep towards the residential areas. And this is really very interesting in the sense that we intuitively knew that was going to happen with the lockdown. We saw around our neighborhoods that people were no longer leaving their homes. People were having their packages delivered, for example, their meals delivered, sometimes their groceries delivered. So then pollution started to shift from the more commercial areas into residential areas. And that's going to be something that's going to help us develop policy, because now what's going on is, especially with some companies that are still encouraging teleworking, working from home, what's happening is now pollution has shifted more towards residential areas than commercial areas.
Yes. I mean, do we have something, though, that we can compare that to prior to?
Well, now what, since we decided to keep the sensors through this time period, what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at this upcoming year. So this calendar year, we'll be redoing this analysis in December, because right now what we found also, what was interesting, was that as soon as the orders were lifted, the lockdown orders were lifted, we didn't see an immediate rebound back to normalcy. As I've mentioned before in the study, locking down a place is relatively easy in the sense that once a command comes through that says we're no longer allowed to function, that's when businesses shut down. Reopening was the tricky part. We actually saw what we called an easing period. That's what we called the period immediately following the lockdown directive ending. And that's when we saw that there was a little bit more activity. And then we saw the reopening period, which is another further 4 months down the line when things started to slowly get back to normal. But things, as you all know, are not probably back to normal yet. But I think that this summer, with the increase in vaccinations, with the increase in just human desire to go out and socialize, now we can really consider that maybe this summer is back to normal. And that's why we've kept the sensors there. So we'll see how these patterns start to emerge.
Oh, we're normal. Believe me. I mean, just in terms of the traffic, because that's really what you're measuring, right? Just the because of the vehicle exhaust?
Well, we're actually measuring. So fine particulate matter comes from many sources, and actually something that's very tricky, and you're experiencing it right now. I'm in Salt Lake, so we actually see it a little bit worse. Wildfires are also part of the signal. So for us, it's also, we need to be able to extract that signal, because something like a wildfire does mute some of the other signal. We also, for example, one of the signals that we captured was wood burning as well. So fine particulate matter comes from many different sources. As you said, traffic is one of the largest ones. There are also dust storms, and as a previous speaker just before me talked about, dust can also be registered as PM2.5. So we do have to do a fair amount of data analysis to really identify what sources there are, because the wildfires that we're seeing right now are probably much larger than the human-caused signal. We also saw during the winter, for example, as I mentioned, the wood burning and many other activities, just any kind of fossil fuel burning as well as dust registers into the PM2.5 signal that we measure.
Yeah, and certainly nobody wants another lockdown again, so my guess is that we will never see the levels go down to what we saw before, huh?
It's unlikely, and I think what that does is, again, removing dust storms and wildfires out of the equation, what I like to see, or what I like to address it at, is that those levels are almost aspirational levels. Those are the levels that Park City can get to with sustainable development, with good planning, and with sufficient use of, for example, renewable energy, etc. So those are achievable levels. And so that's what I want this study to really demonstrate, that those are levels that no one died, no one was hurt. And I'm kind of putting, you know, take this with a grain of salt, in the sense that people were still able to function. Now, things were not at 100%, but I think that that's something that we can all strive for, in terms of, this is a level of air quality that can be reached in Park City.
All right. Now, are we just looking at those two monitors, or were there other monitors that were, you know, targeted?
Those are the two research-grade air quality monitors that were part of the study that I can speak for.
Okay, because I know Summit County also has some air monitoring equipment out and about. Did you have a look at any of those?
We did not use any of those sensors.
Okay, so we're just looking at the two within Park City. All right.
Yes.
So I guess to wrap things up then, I mean, what are the lessons here to be learned as we move forward based on this study?
I think that what we can really see from this result, that I think our world has fundamentally shifted. I think that there will still be a sector of the working force that will be working remotely. And I think that delivery systems have evolved so quickly. I saw so many, for example, meal delivery systems, grocery stores that started to crop up just to answer this demand. And I think that they are not, none of these are really going away anytime soon. And I think that people are going to have to understand and see that there are going to be much more sources of pollution due to delivery, due to home delivery. So we're going to see some of these shifts. I think that many people, for example, now more used to or more open to receiving their meals from their favorite restaurants at home and enjoying that with close friends and family, as opposed to going out to those restaurants. So I think that there is that shift, and we need to be aware that this may be a long-term effect. So we need to understand that. And then really, to go back to the question from a second ago, I think that this is something where we know these are the air quality levels that Park City and really other communities who have had similar studies can aspire to. These are levels that, while the economy obviously was not at its best, while it did affect several individuals and some businesses, I think that we can have much cleaner air than what we're used to. So that's something that we can really take that as a baseline and see where we can realistically aim to cut emissions and to cut pollution to improve the quality of health and the quality of life for our residents.
All right. Where can people read the entire study? Is that online somewhere?
Yes. So the University of Utah has published a news article, and I'm not sure if you can put that up on your website, but it's available there. And as we always like to publish what's called open access, so anyone can read the articles.
Okay. We'll find that link and put it up then later on. Professor Mendoza, anything else you'd like to add?
I just, again, would like to thank the Park City Office's Inability for their support, and also Mark for their support again with helping us place the sensors, and obviously KPCW's roof, because that was a great spot for us to place our sensors.
Right next to a parking garage, yeah. Okay, Professor Mendoza, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Three men were arrested Saturday in the death of a 7-year-old girl who was shot and killed at the Wasatch Commons Apartments Friday night. The young girl was identified by her family as Zai Rodriguez Irizarry. A family friend told KPCW that the Rodriguez family has lived in Utah for nearly a year after moving here from Puerto Rico. Zai lived with her father and two siblings. She was active in school and sports and was beloved around the apartment complex for her magnetic smile and personality. According to the Wasatch County Sheriff's Office, three men were arrested in connection with her death. 34-year-old Christopher R. O'Connell, 36-year-old Colin D. Howells, and 21-year-old Trevor J. Pinter. Pending charges against the three include manslaughter, obstructing justice, and intoxication. O'Connell was charged with manslaughter and being held without bail. Howells was arrested for investigation of sexual battery and intoxication. The anticipated sexual battery charge is not related to Zai's death. Pinter was arrested with obstruction of justice for providing false information to police. Both Howells and Pinter have posted bail and have been released. Formal charges are expected to be filed today. According to the Wasatch County Sheriff's Office, Zai's father called 911 just after 10 p.m. Friday night and said that his 7-year-old daughter had been shot and he was taking her to the Heber Valley Hospital, where she died about 11:30 p.m. Sheriff deputies responded to the hospital as well as the girl's home at the Wasatch Commons apartment on Highway 189 north of Heber and near the UVU Wasatch campus. According to the sheriff's office, just after arriving, deputies heard a gunshot coming from a nearby residence. Deputies approached the area and took three intoxicated men into custody. The Wasatch-backed Major Crimes Task Force is investigating the case. Zai's family and friends have set up a GoFundMe page for those who'd like to help the family with travel and funeral expenses. Zai was a student at a Wasatch elementary school. The Wasatch County School District says it's providing counseling and grief support services at her school for students and staff. Joining me now on the phone, I have the Executive Director of the Park City Education Foundation, Abby McNulty. Good morning, Abby.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's kick it off here. You have got a job opening. Tell us about this.
We do. The Education Foundation is hiring a new Director of Event Marketing and Communications. We have a woman who has been a longstanding colleague of mine, Jennifer Billow, that most of the community knows, certainly anyone who works with the Ed Foundation knows, who's been with us for 10 years. She's still with us. She's not going anywhere. We are just expanding the work of the Education Foundation and hiring on another person to help us with our marquee events, the Red Apple Gala and Running with Ed, and our annual parent appeal that we do during the back-to-school timeframe. So we are looking for a new team member to join, I think, the amazing work of Park City Education Foundation and the really strong team of talented people we have in the organization. And because we are a partner of the school district, all applications move through the Park City School District system. So information on the position is at the Park City School District website, which is pcschools.us.
Okay, so is this a full-time benefited position?
It is, yes.
All right. Again, the benefits would come from the Park City School District then.
That's correct.
Okay. Let's see. And the Ed Foundation, we should note, is a nonprofit 501c3 corporation that basically is, like as you say, partners with the Park City School District, but really provides how much money every year to the district to provide for unfunded needs and wants?
Yes, we invest about $1.5 million into Park City School District and its schools annually. And we do that through our fundraising initiatives, our Give 180 to Beat the Call, Red Apple Gala, Running with Ed, and other organized fundraising that we do with individuals and foundations and corporations. And we do that because Utah is one of the lowest funded education systems in the country, and 96% of the locally collected dollars for education in Summit County are redistributed throughout the state. As many of us know, the southern half of Utah is very rural and much is public land. And so the state of Utah redistributes funds to support other school districts. So they redistribute from Summit County, and it supports something like 7 or 8 other school districts in the state of Utah.
Okay. And what you didn't have to say this time was Utah is the lowest per pupil funding state in the country. Now we're just one of the lowest, huh?
One of the lowest. There were some one-time funds invested into education this year from the legislature. So I think it took us from the very, very bottom to the second to the bottom. But the reality is, you know, many of us have moved here from other parts of the country where our local property taxes are so significant that schools are, you know, funded really, really well and really, really robustly. And frankly, that's just not the case here in our state. And even though we're, you know, a very wealthy community from the outside, we do have 25% of our students living in poverty, and a lot of our tax dollars are redistributed. So if people want to make investments in education locally in our schools, there's really 2 ways to do it. And that is through approving local tax measures and or supporting the Park City Education Foundation.
Okay. Let's see. You also have an update from Bright Futures. First, just tell us what Bright Futures is.
Bright Futures is a program of the Park City Education Foundation run in collaboration with Park City High School and Park City School District. It is a program that supports first-generation college students get to and through college. So these are kids whose parents haven't been to college and don't know how to navigate the system of higher education or what's needed to prepare to enter college financially, academically, all that stuff. So Bright Futures starts working with kids the summer after 9th grade and works with them all through high school. And then most importantly, works with them through college, so the 4 years of college all the way to college graduation. And this is important because first-gen kids, only 11% of low-income first-gen kids after they start school, start college, actually make it to college graduation. And as we know, the working world, your chances of a higher-paying job are just significantly increased if you have a college degree. Those with a college degree make $1 million more over their working life than those without a college degree. So it's a really important program in our community for all the first-gen students that we have here. We're excited. We have 60 kids in the high school portion of the program, and we have 45 kids currently in college, which is pretty amazing and awesome. And the program really provides one-on-one mentoring support to these kids. It's incredibly important over the last 18 months as we battled and challenged COVID, all of us. But then here, all of our first-gen kids are going to school remotely, online, perhaps in a college dorm, but not able to meet other kids because of the COVID restrictions. And it's just been a really, it's been a lifeline for kids who need the additional support on getting through college financially, emotionally, and just navigating the systems of higher ed.
Okay. Now, you work with this summer academy for these ninth graders moving into 10th grade, and you're looking for volunteers for this academy. Tell me, I mean, what is it that the academy does, and what would the volunteers help you with?
Yeah, so the summer academy is like a boot camp of sorts. Maybe that's not the right, it's not, you know, harsh, but it's an intensive 3 or 4 days to give the incoming class of 10th graders an introduction to the program, an introduction to what it is to go to college, why it's important, the difference between a 2-year college and a 4-year college, the difference between a private school and a state school, all the basics of what higher ed looks like in the landscape of higher ed, and to really start, you know, getting them thinking about what are their plans, what are their interests, what do they need to prepare for a four-year degree of a, you know, in-state school versus an out-of-state school, what it costs financially, what they need, you know, in terms of grades and academically, just to start, you know, those wheels turning. And then it's also about creating bonds with their peers, because this program is designed so that peers provide a lot of support to that, you know, to each other, so that they can lift each other up in their journeys to college graduation. And so it's really built as well to create these really strong friendships and peer support groups, as well as introduce them to the different staff members of Bright Futures who will be supporting them on their journey, and as well volunteer mentors helping them along the way. So a volunteer in Bright Futures in the Summer Academy could be doing anything from working with kids to helping set out the drinks and the food for lunch, to cleaning up at the end of the day. It's really a hands-on experience for all volunteers. There's only 2 part-time staff people of the Bright Futures program, and so they very much rely on outside volunteer support to host these kinds of activities, which take place really throughout the year. So Summer Academy is the first week in August, and then there's other activities that take place throughout the year to support students and build these relationships and college knowledge skills.
All right.
And so if anyone's interested, they can go to our website, pcef4kids.org, to sign up to volunteer.
Okay. And I guess I just, there was an article today in today's Salt Lake Tribune about the labor shortage potentially affecting the education sector. Any idea? Have you heard how staffing is looking then for next year?
I have not heard what staff looks like for next year, but I know that that is always a, you know, as a partner to Park City School District, that's certainly a conversation that I think we have at the Ed Foundation all the time, is how do we provide great support to our teachers who are really the number one indicator of student success in a school district. And teachers clearly have had a really challenging year and a half, as well as some other sectors of professionals. And I think, you know, our job is always to think about how we can support them, nurture them, and help them do their job of, you know, impacting student lives. So that's why we have programs like the Classroom Grant, our Emergency Express Grant, and that's why we do the work we do day in and day out. So I don't have specifics, but I will say that that's, you know, that should be a top of everyone's mind, is how do we keep and nurture teachers in our school district.
Okay, appreciate your time. Abby, anything else you want to add?
Just have a wonderful summer. School starts August 19th, and we're busy getting ready for the new school year and enjoying the moments of summer that we have.
Okay. Abby McNulty is Executive Director of the Park City Education Foundation. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.